Hello, and welcome to It's All About Choices. This is the show where my guest and I discuss our lives and our careers framed through the choices that we've made, the good and the bad. For those of you that don't know me, my name is David Barrow, and I've been working in IT service-related roles for coming up to 29 years. 2023 will mark my 30th year in the workplace, and those years have really flown by. And as I approach that 30-year milestone, I've decided it's a great time to reflect on the choices that I've made to lead me up to today. And I do this not just for myself, but because I think it'd be great to share these experiences in order to help others on their career journeys who may face similar choices to those that I and my guests have faced. I'll explore my choices and those of my network of colleagues, customers, mentors, and great friends who are willing to share their experiences via the choices they have made during their lives and careers in IT, or potentially elsewhere. Each episode of It's All About Choices will begin with a period of my own journey, and my guest will be somebody I first met at that time. And here on episode 4 of It's All About Choices, I'll be speaking with Nick Evans. Nick and I first met way back in the year 2000, and Nick is recently retired, having been a long-time employee with IBM. At the time that we met, Nick had taken over the reins as manager of IBM's largest help desk, during a period when I was transitioning from being a help desk analyst to a more service management-focused professional. My career choices and my behaviours have been heavily influenced by Nick and the faith that he put into me at a time when he possibly had more faith in me than I did in myself. So we'll reflect on the choices that led to us working together and those we've made since, as well as those choices that are still to come. So this should be a really fun and insightful episode, and please feel free to ask questions or make points as we run through the episode. And thank you for joining us on It's All About Choices. So, Nick, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, David. How are you? It's been a long time. We've not really spoken very much since my days on the help desk, but it's very good to speak.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really good thing about doing this is I'm managing to reconnect with people who I haven't spoken to for a long time, but always remained in contact with, but not had a good sit down sort of chin wag with. So, yeah, I really appreciate you coming on. It's really kind of you, especially as I approached you out of the blue with very little preamble, just do you fancy joining me on this and talking about our time together and our time since. So let's go back, if we may. You and I first met in, so I think it was the year 2000. You came on to take on a large behemoth of a help desk. And I'd be really interested to know about kind of the choices that led you to that day in your career and life.
Yeah, well, I had been man and boy in IT computer operations until that point. From school, I worked at Lloyds Bank in their computer center at Sampson House at Blackfriars, which is no longer there, I don't think, and was there a couple of years, and then went to work for Sun Alliance, who are based in Horsham, doing the same sort of thing. I went through the ranks with Sun Alliance, computer operator, senior operator, that sort of thing, to shift leader, and then ultimately to operations manager. And then in 96, IBM came along, and my role and my teams were outsourced to Big Blue. So that was 96, and then life changed suddenly for us, and you go through all the emotions of why us, you know, why are we being outsourced to, well, actually, this might not be a bad thing, because IT careers for a big IT service provider have to be more varied and more available than perhaps in the IT department of an insurance company. So from there, the operation moved down to North Harbour at Portsmouth, where I stayed with it for a couple of years. And then because we were one of the largest outsourcing projects to date, I suddenly became very marketable. They said, well, you've brought your team into IBM, go and do the same for others. So I was shipped up to Warwick, where most of the commercial accounts were being run from, and was asked to bring in the Asda ops from Leeds into Warwick and the Bradford and Bingley ops from Bingley into Warwick. And I did that for a couple of years. And then someone said, well, would you fancy going up to Warrington and working on cable and wireless? And that's where their operation was based. So I had a year living in the Holiday Inn at Junction 21 on the M6, which was a pretty good year, other than it was, long journeys on Monday morning or Sunday night and Friday afternoon. Babysitting the operation at Cable and Wireless through the millennium. And then soon in the year 2000, I believe the year had come to an end up in Warrington, and it was, well, what's next? And I think it was Kevin Dawson, who was the PE on, or at least the delivery executive on Cable and Wireless, said, well, we need someone to run the help desk down in Brentford. How about it? Now, having spent the previous X number of years, 15, 16 years in operations, I hadn't got a clue about anything else other than IT operations. However, I had a broad awareness of IT and services and so on. And it was, of course, an opportunity to work a bit close to home and not be in Warrington. So I pretty much accepted the job without really seeing it. It's like buying a house without looking at it first. So I went into Brentford on my first day and thought, well, this is the help desk, and met you all. So it was really just an opportunity to do something completely different and just step out of my comfort zone, because, say, until that point, I'd known nothing outside of mainframe and mid-range operations. So it was a bit of a baptism of fire and a bit bewildering, and I was probably more nervous than I let on at the time. But, you know, just a real opportunity to do something completely different.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So I honestly don't recall any nerves, but what I do recall, and it came out of the conversations I had with Marion and Derek, actually, that they too kind of arrived at that point through more an element of judgment, but also an element, well, let's give it a go. See what happens. And in Derek's case, complete career change. He was working in forensics at the time. So and I know you said that it was a bit like sort of buying a house without looking at it. Do you reflect back and think that was a choice that you made that was a good one, and it kind of panned out how you expected, or a choice that you made that maybe panned out differently but still ultimately was a good one?
In hindsight, now, I would say it was the best decision I ever made. I look back at my time on the help desk as the role where I learned the most about myself. I learned the most about how to manage teams, how to get the most out of people, how to work in an extremely diverse environment. And apart from anything else, I guess just finding out that I could put my hand to something where I didn't really have any experience of it. And pretty much all my roles after that were things that I hadn't really done before. So it gave me confidence to try things that I probably didn't deep down feel very qualified to do. And I didn't feel qualified to run a help desk. I knew what a help desk was. And I knew that people phoned up and people on the end of the phone would fix what they could and pass on to technical teams what they couldn't. But that was about it. And I didn't know anything else really about how a help desk ran. So it's highly dependent on the people, the very many experts who were working on the help desk to help me through it, if you like.
Yeah, and we were a big team, weren't we? I mean, we were a diverse, large team who'd kind of all been brought in to run that thing. So it must have been quite daunting for you coming into.
Yeah, and the other thing was I hadn't really, to any great extent, had contract workforce, and the desk was, I think when I joined, it was something like 60 or 70 people, but half of those were manpower agency contractors, and they had their own on-site manpower.
Right.
But it brought itself a whole new set of problems, because they weren't our employees, they were manpower employees, but nevertheless we were their task manager, and it was up to us to keep them happy, and they would have as much say or have as many concerns about the way things were being run as the regular IBM employees. So again, it was a whole new set of problems, something that I hadn't really encountered before.
Yeah, God, you've reminded me now, because I remember going down there as a manpower employee and being over the moon when I finally got made into an IBMer, which I think was probably around 2000. That's something that's just come back to me. And I remember dealing with, it was Sarah who looked after us from the manpower perspective.
Yeah.
And being absolutely over the moon when I finally became an IBMer after I think it was, I'd been with the company 3 years at that point and moved down there. So I think we were quite high in numbers and high in calls. I recall myself as an analyst there taking over 100 calls a day, trying to smash out my first time fix and keep my average speed of answer nice and low. So it was a really, really interesting time. I'd like to ask you a question about the time, because it was around that time when you arrived that I'd stopped actually being an analyst. And thinking back, I suspect maybe I became an IBMer because of the role that I took on, which was, if I remember correctly, was quality and customer satisfaction leader. I think it was quite a mouthful and quite an elevated role for a help desk analyst at the time. But my role was looking at those things, you know, how we were satisfying the customer and the quality of our work and our calls. And I recall you and I going to a meeting with a senior member of the customer base, because the service was maybe not to the standard that they'd like, but we were improving it. And in this meeting, we were speaking to the customer, and I remember saying to Marion on a previous episode that working with Marion on that desk was the first time I felt empowered. Marion ran the team in that manner. She gave us all the empowerment to do what we could do. And I remember with yourself being in that meeting, and the customer was looking at a presentation that I was delivering and listened, and then hit me with a question which I was able to answer. But then started suggesting that we still weren't improving in line with expectation, that we maybe the figures were not truthful, but they were. And challenging me, and I recall it being a very difficult moment for me, because I was used to the challenge on the telephone, less used to it face to face, and also less used to it from a very senior individual in the customer organization. But what I remember about that moment was your support. You kind of pacified the customer, but whilst doing so, supported me, explained how we'd come to the conclusions we'd come to and the steps we were taking to improve. And I remember the customer, maybe it was your position, maybe it's the way you did it, but going, okay, I'm good with this, and just we carried on. But for me, that was a massive moment, because having that support meant so much to me. And I was just wondering if that way of managing people and working was like a conscious choice for yourself, and how you kind of arrived at that.
I think it was a necessity in many ways, David. I think in my first job as a manager, I'd gone through the ranks, through the operations ranks. And so although I was managing a team of people, I was, to an extent, a subject matter expert in everything they did. So nothing they did, I didn't know about. When I joined the help desk, I knew pretty much nothing, but I was surrounded by other subject matter experts who did know what they were talking about. So my job evolved really from being an expert in what the team does to being one of more, what I would say, support and facilitating, if you like. So once I'd spoken to you and you'd said, well, this is how we're going to improve the service, and I'd bought into that, you would have my total support. So when we were sitting with the customer and the customer was questioning it, it was my job then to reassure the customer that, yes, we did have his service, his best intentions at heart, and what we were doing really was going to improve the service delivered to him. And so it was more a case perhaps of adding a little bit of clout and hearing it from someone else rather than just you, if you like, even though I hadn't got a clue what I was talking about in many ways. I was able to add some weight to the argument and just reassure him. But I think, in other roles, it has been the same. You know, I found myself after the help desk role increasingly having to do the same and hear it from the horse's mouth and then represent that to senior members of the client to say, this is what we're doing to address the problem, even though it wasn't my solution. It was just one that I was supporting and reinforcing. I think one thing, David, early in my career, I had a manager who said to me, most managers say, these people work for me. He said, the best managers say, I work for these people. And that's something which stuck with me there on after, really. And it's something which I tried to apply, but really had no choice to but to do that, because you know, at the end of the day, if your team is delivering and your subject matter experts and your team leaders are delivering, then everything else is easy. So the emphasis definitely changed from supporting and enabling people like yourself to deliver, and then everything else has clicked into place.
Yes, it's really interesting. One of the reasons that I kind of wanted to set up this webcast was to talk about those little nuggets, those things that we hear from others, that whether it's a piece, you know, being supported, whether it's in your case hearing it from a manager about, you know, the team and so on, and how they help others throughout their career journey. And I speak with people an awful lot at different, at varying stages of their journey, and some lack confidence, some have loads of confidence, others are senior, some are junior. But I think the thing that comes through is that we can all help one another. And I think just hearing, I remember that day and it really helped me, but it's really interesting for me to hear how others had helped you on the path to that day as well. Because at the time I saw you as this, wow, this is amazing, Nick supporting me, you know, kind of almost blew my mind, so to speak, even though that was always the case, and others have said so too, but I think it's great just to break it down and talk about it.
Yeah, and I found the best way, or the only way I could survive on the help desk, was talking to as many people as I possibly could. I mean, in the early days, you'll remember it, the service was struggling. We had lots of red on the sheets. We were hemorrhaging service credits, you know, six figures a month we were paying back to the customer because we weren't delivering the service. And I was being sent poisonous emails saying, you need to fix this. And it was, well, how do we do that? So the only way I could do it, to sit down, not only with people like yourself and people like Maria and Julia at the time, and Dave on the stats and people like that, but to sit down with some of the manpower people, anyone who wanted to talk really, and saying, you know, what's going wrong? What can I do to help you? And one of the issues, as an example, was that we were losing quite a lot of the manpower people. They would come into IBM, they would do their year or so and get IBM on the CV, and they disappear. And I remember talking to a lady called Dion, and her saying to me, well, people are leaving because they can go elsewhere and get a couple of thousand more, and a couple of thousand because they weren't earning a huge amount was a lot. And so I remember putting a case together for Kevin Dawson and saying, you know, our manpower people aren't paid enough for working in central London. So the 30 people we've got, we need to give them, you know, a 2,000, 2,500 pay rise across the board. And of course, you can imagine in IBM, that went down like a lead balloon. You know, what do you mean? And I said, well, look, it wasn't too difficult to sell because, you know, I said, you know, we are paying more out a month in service credits than this will cost us in a year. And the difference in quality of the service, because we'll retain the people and won't be losing quite so many people, will be huge. And after a month or two, I think they were paying out so much money in service credit, they just, oh, go on, just do it. And we did. And I think then it kind of not only gave the people a bit more money, but it gave them a bit of confidence that actually we were listening to what they had to say and prepared to do something about it. And I feel, you know, there was a shift, wasn't there? I remember, you know, when things were really going pear-shaped, we said, and with, you know, we have a major outage and we have 200 calls waiting in the queue. And he said, right, everyone needs to drop everything and go and pick up the phone. And I was picking up the phone as well. I couldn't do much with it. But at least it was, you'd stop the call from being abandoned. You'd answer the call quickly and you could take someone's details and say, look, really sorry, but we're up against it. Someone will call you back in a few minutes. Just to get over that initial sort of avalanche of calls and so on. But yeah, but you know, going back to the point, I think it was a case of needing to talk to everyone and get everyone's point of view so that everyone felt they were being listened to. And it wasn't just a case of, this is the way we're going to do it and dictate things to people.
Absolutely. I'm just going to share this comment from Bex, who's watching us live in New Zealand. So I'm making that 3 in the morning, which is incredible. Thanks for the support, Bex. Bex was also my host in New Zealand, and James, her husband, he and I worked together at Fidelity, and Bex was there too. So, but Bex makes a really good point. She's made a couple of points, but I love this one, that your leader should always have your back, empowers you to do your job. And I certainly always felt that way on the service desk for yourself and Marion. And you've just reminded me as well that, you know, during that period, I remember us doing things that I still do today. So we built the knowledge base, because then we had enough people there, as in retaining, that we were able to extract the knowledge from them to then go and build our knowledge base, which started to improve our first time fix. And I think that was the subject of the presentation that we were delivering that day. And again, I hadn't remembered the subject until you started making that point, and I'm pretty sure it is. And bless Bex. Bex, seriously, it's 3 a.m. You can watch this again on YouTube, but I really appreciate you staying up for it. Thank you. I hope the kids don't wake you up too early in the morning. So I believe we moved on at similar times from the help desk. I think I moved on maybe late 2001, early 2002. Late 2001, early 2002. Sorry, get my times right. And I think you may have moved on around the same time. So what choices did you make after that?
It was, well, I mean, the decision to leave the desk was both easy and difficult. The service had gone from being very red to green across the board, and was, and I think Marion said it on the last call, it was almost I'd done as much as I could. We'd taken the desk as far as I could take it, and it needed someone else to continue it. It by then had become a global help desk, and it was both Brentford and Manchester. And Sun Alliance, that I'd started my career with, in the meantime had merged with the Royal to make RSA, and there was a second wave of outsourcing happened in 2002, and there was an opportunity to go and manage desktop support teams for the south part of the country, so Birmingham southwards, for the new account, if you like. So that was one reason. The other reason, if I'm brutally honest, is I was exhausted. The help desk, although it was the most fantastic job, and I still say the best job I had in IBM, I was absolutely exhausted. And it wasn't until I stopped doing it that I realised how tired I was. And if you remember, the desk used to start at 7 in the morning.
Yeah, that was my shift.
Go on till 6:30 in the evening. And for a large proportion of my 22 months or so I was on the desk, I was leaving home at 5:30 to be in when the desk opened, and I was there when the desk closed, and getting home at 8:30, 9 o'clock, and to do that indefinitely, particularly when the chips were down, if it was like one of these things, well, if the ship's sinking, I'm going down with it. But it wasn't until I stopped doing it that I realized just how tired I was and how much it had taken out of me. The opportunity to go back and work with teams from RSA meant I was going to be based at the RSA data center, which was walking distance from where I live, which is why we were here in the first place, because back in my Sun Alliance days, the data center was built in the late 80s, and bought a house so I could walk to work. And then say, once I was outsourced, I was anywhere except there. Work a bit closer to home. But again, do something completely different. Yeah, this role was to manage distributed computing, desktop support type teams, delivering service for RSA customers. So their main offices were, and Horsham was the main hub, but they had people in Birmingham, Bristol, Chelmsford, Peterborough, places like that. So although there was an element of travelling, my dot ball, as it were, was to walk into work at Lennoxwood, which is, say, a mile or so away, which was great. So I could go travelling once a week, but it would be once a week, not all day, every day. So that was an opportunity to do something completely different and learn a new skill. Again, it's variation on the theme, really. Desktop teams have service levels to achieve, the same as the help desk did, and they have SLAs and KPIs and this, that, and the other. So it was variation on the theme. And again, the same as the help desk, I relied heavily on the team leaders based at each of those sites to say, tell me what you do. Tell me how I can help you improve what we do. And I did that for 4 years or so. But again, it was good. It was completely different. Very steep learning curve initially. But again, it was a good experience.
perhaps. And did you find, because I would guess that as that team, they would probably receive calls or receive tickets from help desk. Did you find that the background of working, you were almost now sort of an element of empathy with what was coming over? Because there's often a, certainly in my experience, there's often a disconnect between those receiving the ticket and those sending the ticket over, being polite.
Yeah, and I think to an extent, the desktop teams initially anyway showed a lack of empathy, and they didn't really realise what goes on at the help desk. In the meantime, the RSA help desk had moved to Bangalore, so it was all new to them as well. Mm. And as I say, I think desktop teams might have shown a bit more empathy and compassion than they did. But as you say, it helped, but by then I understood the path of the ticket. I understood that the call goes into the help desk, and what can get fixed does, and what can't gets sent out to the technical teams, and then they have the rest of the service level to fix it and so on. So yeah, it's good to have had that help desk experience to understand the path of a ticket, if you like, and also what the help desk teams were having to deal with when there were major incidents.
Absolutely, and I still lean on those experiences of 20 odd years ago working on the help desk, because they're still the source, that's still where things come from, and it's still very similar. There's new technologies, but the practices and customer service haven't changed a great deal, neither have customer reactions. And yeah, in my consulting roles now, those days working on that help desk, doing those long hours, not as long as yours, in fairness. I remember I was always seconding because you always beat me, but I lived around the corner in Acton. But everything I learned there really is a solid foundation for everything I do today. And as I say, a lot of it comes from the trust and the faith that yourself and Marion gave me. So that's great. But then you went into project management. Now, that strikes me as an odd choice.
Well, it was an odd choice, but I guess in some ways I was missing help desk stuff, and there was an opportunity. You know, I said that the desktop teams lacked empathy for the help desk, but the help desk service at times wasn't great. So I was asked if I'd be interested in going to run a project, given my previous experience of help desk matters, to improve the service delivered out of the Bangalore help desk. So I spent some time in Bangalore looking at what they did. And it was partly to just bread and butter service improvement, but partly setting up what they called a command center, which was using a clever bit of software, and I forget what it was called now. But anyway, what it would do would simulate user transactions that would run in the background on the same applications that the users were using, to identify any problems, so that hopefully we'd know the problems and be able to fix them before the users even identify themselves. So this was really useful when things come up in the morning at 5 or 6 in the morning, and these things would all run and say, "Oh, I can't talk to server X," and they'd call someone out and get it fixed before historically they'd have waited for the user to come in and say, "I can't get in, what's the problem?" So that was a little project I ran for about a year or so. And I was the only IBM person there. I was working with RSA people, so that was again a different experience, because I was the only IBMer and the rest were customers, if you like. But it did give me a chance to go to Bangalore a couple of times, and met some people who are, you know, a couple of people who are now lifelong friends, went to their wedding and so on. So it's, you know, it was again a great experience, but always ever only going to be a year or so. So that came to an end after about a year, at which point I was having to say, well, what am I going to do now? And the opportunity came along to work in service management, which was the next prong, if you like. So I spent a couple of years managing teams of service management personnel, so delivery service managers, change managers, problem managers, incident managers, that sort of thing, for accounts typically based in the South. So it was essentially a people management position, but I also provided an account interlock, if you like, an escalation point for the accounts that I was running on. So I think back then the main one I was running on was DEFRA. Do you remember DEFRA?
I worked on DEFRA. Yeah.
So DEFRA was one, ICI in Slough, RSA, of course, in Horsham, and a few others. But it was essentially a people management position. So I have 50-odd people. So it was quite hard. And I then came to the conclusion that one person can't manage 50 people. It's just not properly anyway. But did that for a couple of years. And if I'm brutally honest with you, David, I was just about ready to leave IBM at that point. I was quite disillusioned at the way that Global Technology Services, as it was then, ran things, particularly around things like appraisals and forced distribution, if you like. So, you know, if you've got a team of 50 people, tell me who your 7 or 8 poor performers are. And that didn't sit with me. And I said, I can't do what you're asking me to do. I remember sitting in rooms in Warwick with other people doing the same role, looking after, you know, collectively maybe 400 service management personnel, and them saying, you know, 7 or 8 in the evening, we're not leaving this room to have identified another 10 poor performers, if you like. And that really didn't sit well with me. And I said, well, I can't do this. I'm out.
You've hit the nail on the head as to why one of the reasons I moved on from Capgemini.
And I just can't do this. And you know, to be fair, there were 7 or 8 of us managers in the room. And we said, well, if you need more people, put us down. And if it's just a numbers game, put us down. But it really didn't sit well with me. And I said, I'm not prepared to manage by numbers. You know, you're asking us year on year to deliver more, and you expect more. And we lose people because of various resource actions. But you still want to find your poor performers. You know, accepting there are always people that perform better than others. I don't agree with pointing your finger and saying, you know, in your team of 50, you must have 7 or 8 poor performers. That didn't work with me at all, I'm afraid. So, as luck would have it, an account came along, Friends Provident, based in Dorking. And the way that outsourced accounts worked was that the DPE, a delivery executive, would not only have to deliver the service to the customer, but initially they would have all the people who had been outsourced attached to them, which meant that if someone sneezed, they'd get an email. If you know, any password resets, anything out of hours payments, anything that you'd expect a people manager to do was going to the DPE. And frankly, they just didn't have time to do it. So I put my hand up and said, well, what you need is someone to go and take some of that people management admin away from you. So I went to Friends Provident and worked with a chap called AJ Jones. Remember him?
No, I don't actually.
So I worked with him. So there were about 100 IBMers and 50-odd manpower people. And I took all the people management admin and legwork away from him for about a year, 18 months, through various resource actions. Because inevitably, when companies outsourced, there was a cost plan that said X number of roles were going to be moved offshore and so on. And so various employee consultations and selection processes to determine which people would stay and which people would go. And for some people, if they were told your job no longer exists, they'd rub their hands together because it was a nice healthy redundancy package. For others, they it was the worst thing that could happen. And so that for those people, there was quite a lot of resource management and helping those people find alternative roles within the organization. So typically on those accounts, I would work with them until they were what we used to call layered. So, you know, initially they'd work as a towered organization. And then over time, they'd gradually be aligned to the organization so that the service management people would align to service management, and the desktop teams will align to that organization. The technical teams will align to the various teams in that part of the organization. So I did that one on Friends Provident for probably 18 months, I think. And then again, as luck would have it, Legal & General was about to outsource an even bigger number of people, and they were going to be based out of Lennox Wood, initially Tadworth. So I was there for a bit, but they moved to Lennox Wood. But again, it was the same thing. I wrote to the DPE and said, you do realise that when you take on these 150 people, you're going to get 150 people's worth of people admin. Oh, didn't realise that, and convinced him that he needed a me, if you like, to come and take that off his hands. So went and did that for that one for another 18 months, 2 years or so. And then again, I was, once I'd done that, after that, after Legal & General, when they'd been aligned to the rest of the organisation, there were a couple of small ones. There was Sandvik up in Birmingham. But at that point, again, I was still on the face of it employed by Global Technology Services. And although it had, to an extent, alleviated the problem that I'd had in service management with false distributions of appraisals and so on, it hadn't gone away. And so I was looking for a next opportunity, whether that was going to be in IBM or outside of IBM. Mm-hmm. And someone sent me a job opportunity. I can't remember who it was. I think it was someone in HR sent me an opportunity for a role that was in Software Group, which was Acquisitions Integration Manager, which was essentially managing the integration of acquired teams into IBM for the first months of their journey, if you like. And so I went to talk to people in Software Group and went to talk to the manager in that team and a couple of her managers, and joined Software Group, where I was for the last 8 years or so of my career, which was, I have to say, a bit of a saviour, because, as I say, Software Group was a real breath of fresh air compared to what I'd been used to at GTS. And it was one of these moments you say, well, I should have done this years ago. But it was actually quite tricky, because then, if you remember, you work in GTS, and that's where you work. But although it's still part of the same organisation, to get approval to join a completely separate part of the organisation was very, very difficult. So my new manager had to pull a few strings and go up quite high in the chain to get approval to take me on into Software Group. So, yes, and I spent the last 8 years of my career managing teams of people making their journey into IBM. So at the point that a deal was closed, you would get in amongst the team and introduce yourself. You'd take them through employee consultation. But for once, it wasn't a redundancy type consultation. It was a, this is what your T's and C's are going to be in IBM. And then the role touched, it was great because it touched on all sorts of areas. It touched on HR through the employee consultation stuff. It touched on procurement, because often there were contractors, there were always services involved to migrate across. Touched on finance for obvious reasons. Resource management, because sometimes people's roles weren't a natural fit into IBM. You know, if a company came in with, say, a payroll clerk, I said, well, we've got a huge engine of stuff that happens down in Portsmouth. Your job doesn't really exist in IBM. So helping those people to find alternative roles. It touched on IT, so laptop deployment, mobile phone deployment, and so on. Just everything that someone from another company would need to be able to do their job with an IBM badge. So that was really good. And there were a number of different acquisitions I worked on. And each one would last typically a year or so, but each acquisition was completely different. You know, the dynamics and the people and the culture were always different. I mean, some of them would be full of young, vibrant people where music and beer in the office was the thing. Others were, dare I say, white middle-aged men with pinstripe suits and more formal. So it was really good to get involved with things and trying to adapt your style depending on who you're working with.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm kind of reflecting on what you've been saying, and your career, it's over sort of 40 odd years. It's almost a tale of two halves. You've got your ops roles for 20 years, and then your people focused leadership roles for the next 20. And it just occurred to me, because you wouldn't, in my experience at least, obviously you are proof that I'm wrong, you wouldn't normally see somebody who's a heavy ops person end up in those roles. So was that something that, because I know you said earlier, like the help desk was almost buying a house without seeing it. Were you consciously searching for that type of role? Or did it really just come like that?
I think so, David. I think the trouble is, having worked for so long in operations, it was a case that I didn't know what I didn't know. Like, so I didn't really know what was out there. So it was a case of, well, let's try something, see if it fits. But I think the help desk role gave me an opportunity to work with so many different people. And I think it probably did make me realize that actually I was better at managing people than I was actually managing a service.
It's a theme that keeps coming out in these conversations. Is that whole, you know, I myself started as a coder. I was terrible at it. You know, we kind of start somewhere and we make some conscious or unconscious choices that lead us on this path. And I love the fact, just chatting to you, that you've kind of got that clear demarcation of two halves. But I also know that you, we've got 5 minutes. I'd like to just cover one or two other points. You ended up working on the European Works Council as well. So that must have been really stimulating.
That was a fantastic experience, I have to say. That was just one of these things that came out of the blue. There was an email from the UK HR director to say there's an opportunity for someone to be the UK representative on the European Works Council. And my colleague said, yeah, go for it. And so I put my name into the hat, and there were probably 20 or 30 people all had to produce a paragraph as to almost like your candidate election statement. So why me? And it went to a vote and I was voted in. So for the last 5 years or so, I was the UK rep on the European Works Council, which meant, well, certainly before the pandemic hit us, meant twice a year we would meet formally for a week, either in Brussels or Madrid, were the places we typically went to. But in between those, if there were emergency meetings called, and that would be typically if IBM had announced that there were going to be widespread resource actions, and so we would go to another location and try and understand why and what could be done to reduce or mitigate the need to lose headcount and so on. But it was a most fantastic experience and an opportunity to work with opposite numbers from 17 European countries and so on. But the whole experience felt a bit like, you can imagine what it's like working in the European Parliament. So we all sat with headphones on and people in booths around the outside. And so everything anyone says, I always had the advantage because I was the English speaker, and everything was then translated into 17 different languages, if you like, or a dozen different languages anyway. It was a fantastic experience. I loved it. And it was an opportunity to meet very senior members, senior members are from the business, so people from DTS and finance and HR, just to understand why the company was taking some of the decisions it was taking, and to question and challenge and so on. That was really good. Unfortunately, Brexit largely put pay to that, and as I left the organisation, the UK was then starting to think, well, now the UK is no longer part of the EU. Do we need to have a representative on the Works Council, and looking at all the realities of that? So I probably got out at the right time from the Works Council point of view, but also from my own point of view as well, I think. My role had moved from being UK and Ireland base to a more European role, but then we were taken over. The management were then based in the States, so it then meant that you're on conference calls at being a global team, then on conference calls with someone in Australia at 7 in the morning and on conference calls at 10 at night with someone in the States. And I just thought, I'm getting too old for this. and the thing is, a lot of people have said to me, you will know when the time's right to retire. And they were, and I thought, well, not sure about that, but they were absolutely spot on. And when the time was right, I said, you know what? I've had enough of this. I don't need it anymore. It's too much stress, too much aggravation. I've had a good time, but now's the time to go and concentrate on, dare I say, some of the more important things in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And so let's get to those. We've got a minute or two, but I'd love to hear about those choices you're making now, or how to fill your time. It must be amazing.
Well, stuff. I spend a lot of time pursuing or doing all the things that I had to fit around work previously. So I spend a lot of time outside. We love walking. I still play hockey, and I take lots of sports photographs, primarily hockey photographs. So I have a sort of, like most of them go on social media, but I've also got a little job working at one of the universities in Brighton, taking sports photographs for them on a Wednesday afternoon. So that's just a little, you know, a little pocket money job, but it's great to be able to do something which is my passion and I love mm-hmm. doing. I spend most of my Saturdays, I say, either playing or taking hundreds or thousands, dare I say, photographs of people running around chasing a ball around, and then most of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday going through the editing process and publishing and so on. So although I'm not doing anything that earns me any money, I'm doing things that make me happy. So
yeah, that's fantastic. And I think also doing photography myself, having the time to do the edit is probably more important than having the time to take the photo.
It is. Themselves. I mean, if I go and take pictures of a game, people are sending me messages an hour afterwards saying, have you got any pictures of today's game? I say to them, look, you know, the game takes an hour and a quarter or so. It will take me 6 hours or so to go through all those photographs and straighten and crop and this sort of thing and discard the ones I don't want. I think they just think I just download them at the camera and upload them onto the laptop and that's it. But it does, you're right, it's hugely time consuming. And, you know, sometimes I might take a couple of games on a Saturday and a game on a Sunday, and that will take me most of the following week to do. I also walk a neighbour's dog for him, which is gets me out of the house in the morning because he's got a border collie, but the owner's had a hip replacement. So I do that for a couple of hours before the day starts in the morning.
Still an early riser.
Yeah, I get out of the house. You know, I haven't had to set an alarm for as long as I can remember. So I don't get up particularly early now, but I'm out of the house walking the dog at 8 o'clock till about 9:30, 10:30, and then get on with whatever's planned for the day, whether that's editing photographs or whatever. So
that's great. Well, I think that is a brilliant place to bring this to a close. I honestly can't say enough how much I appreciate not just you coming on the show, but also genuinely the support you gave me all those years ago. It's really helped help me with my career, and I know it's helped many others. I've spoken to Dave Horn. He sent his regards and said exactly the same. And I know it's not just us two that you've helped. So thank you so much. Thanks for coming on today, and thanks for sharing your choices and with all the viewers.
No, you're very welcome. It's been a bit like This Is Your Life without the red book, but it's been quite fun looking back over the last almost 40 years and just revisiting what I did and just asking myself why I did what I did when and so on. So it's been great to talk and catch up.
Oh, that's good. That's brilliant. That's the whole purpose. Thank you. Well, thanks, Nick. And thank you to everybody for joining in, especially Bex. If you're still awake, well done you. It must be very early now, or you've been up all night having fun. I hope it's the latter. So thanks, everybody. Goodbye.